Okay. Can everyone hear me correctly? Okay, great. I'm not too used to talk with a microphone, so I'll do my best to keep it correct distance. So my name is Olivier. I'm from the aerospace sector.
Yeah, please come in. I'm the technician. Just put it like this.
Just like this. Okay.
Closer to you.
Closer to my mouth. Okay, great. So my name is Olivier. I'm from the aerospace sector, and today I'd like to talk about the relation between computing and energy. It's a great pleasure, great privilege to be here. I'll do my best to entertain you, knowing that the other lectures at the same time had sex and cloud in the title. So I'm particularly grateful for your presence here today. Yeah, so it means a lot to me. So basically the idea that ignited this talk is that as every geek comes along into a new place, lands in a new place, the first thing he or she does is look for two kinds of signals to plug in the machine. One is power and the other is information. And I've always been wondering about the relation between these two signals and these two types of cables here. So what I want to do today is make an informal exploration of the relation between computing and energy. I really mean really insist on the fact that it's informal. This is not a research report. It's clearly a narrative and a personal exploration of what it means to flip digits with regards to our energy resources in the world. So the question I set to ask, and I won't be able to answer it completely, you'll see, is should a simple network operation, should it just typing ping.ccc.de require any energy at all? Should it be free? Could we make it so that it costs nothing in terms of energy? So I won't be able to give a quantitative answer. It's just a personal journey through that question here. And I really look forward to your opinion, your input during and after the lecture on this matter. Okay, so very quickly I'll run through a couple of basic ideas about energy and power, the important notions you should know. The first thing you learn about energy typically at school, if you did the same studies as I do, is that it's measured in joules. We usually skip the definition part and talk about units straight away, and then this curious property, which is that it cannot be destroyed. It can always be transformed and shifted along a long path, but never be destroyed. And that's not so intuitive when you think about it. Just imagine being in a car at 100 kilometers per hour on the motorway, and you come to a stop. You killed your speed, but the energy is still there. It's dissipated in the brakes, usually a little bit around the car in the air, but the energy is still there. So it's always transformed, always pushed along, never destroyed or created. Units joules. Another unit that's used for historical reasons, especially in the electrical power sector, is the kilowatt hour, so the energy you spend with the 1,000 watt power during an hour over there. A joule is a very small amount of energy. Stepping on a chair will cost you 500 joules. Turning a augmented vegetarian pizza into a cooked augmented vegetarian pizza will already cost you 1,000,000 joules. Right? So it's a very small unit. So when we talk about energy, always be careful about what the meaning of a joule are. Power. Power is how much energy you can spend per second. It's measured in watts. So again, watts is a small amount of power in our scale. Much better and much more intuitive unit for power is a horsepower, which is aptly named after the power that a strong horse can give continuously pulling something, about 700 watts. And a human like you and me, somebody who's not really trained, pushing on the bicycle, will probably give around 200 watts, so about a third of a horsepower. Approximately. So again, these are just scales to set us in the exploration. Okay, so converting energy. How do we go from a source of very raw, very concentrated energy into something with which we can flip digits, into the flipping of digits on the device? Well, you start with oil, you start with carbon-based chemical energy, you change that energy into heat, into very random vibrations of matter, usually a gas, could be water, could be air, but it could also be a solid, a metal or something. With that heat, you convert that heat into work, so you make your machine work. Work is essentially the movement of a visible part, something that we can observe, visually. So usually your rotation of something spinning around, a turbine, for example, or maybe something moving along in longitudinal movement, a car moving along, maybe just a piston moving up and down. From there on, we spin the magnet inside a coil and convert that movement of the visible movement of a part into the movement, tiny movement back and forth, or longitudinal movement of electrons inside the cable. And that gives us a lot more flexibility in the way we handle the power. It's very easy, as you can see probably all the way through the building, to move electricity along, much harder to move mechanical power along. And then we get from that mystical and very mystifying, to me, still unclear relation between electrical power and that ability to flip digits, to move information along on matter. That's only part of the story, though, because every time you move energy along the chain here, you lose some, and you lose a great deal of it. The efficiency of the transfer, of the transformation of energy, is very limited. So you burn oil, and you convert that into a useful heat you can give to a fluid, and you lose heat along the power. So do you when you convert heat into work, actually quite a lot of heat, usually typically between a third and a half of the energy is wasted here in this process of changing heat into work, and so on and so forth until you get there. So the picture is a lot more subtle, a lot more complicated than it first seems. Another interesting thing, I think, about... just before the next interesting thing, just to give you an idea of how much fuel, how much energy you need to power an ordinary computer. That computer here is right now is burning about 30 watts of electricity at the plug, so just before the charger, which then goes into the PC. How much fuel energy is needed in the process at the other side of the grid? Typically, the efficiencies are just like that, 95% for chemical energy to heat, 70% in a good fission plant for fuel to work, and work to electricity, 85%. Gives you an overall efficiency about 50 to 60% overall. So your 30 watts here that you pull from the plug at the wall here actually will cost you about 50 watts of chemical energy poured into the power plant on the other side of the grid. And that translates into how much fuel? Very little fuel, actually. So to power your computer, you're burning about a drop of fuel every 30 seconds. Dripping into the power plants on the other side, right? So not much to start with, but you have to keep in mind that chemical energy is extremely dense, right? The tiny drop of fuel will get you a long way in our scale of energy. It amounts to about a liter a week, just to give you a sort of idea of the amount of energy you need for that. A car will burn about a liter an hour driving normally. Okay, another very interesting thing about this conversion of energy is that in the end, it all ends up as heat. I mean, this is the intended end process, but in the grand scale of things, it's just only one step. And the next step to that is that everything that you do with your computer is converted into heat. My favorite example is the beamer right here, the projector right here, which I had trouble installing, which we usually see as an energy transforming machine, right? It's getting power from the grid and putting light on the board. But the light is useful to us, but in the end, it's all converted to heat. All of it, 100% of the energy eaten by this machine is converted to heat, right? In this instance, right there. So we have to keep in mind that it's a very complex relationship. And the picture of the energy path from the raw energy source we take to our energy device is really complex and muddy. Okay, let me just go back a few slides to this idea here. There's a couple more things I want to say about this path to powering your computer. One of which is that it doesn't matter where the efficiencies are, actually. You can interchange these efficiencies and still get the same result, the same power. Well, for a given power at the plug, it will require the same amount of chemical power at the entrance of the plant on the other side, regardless of where that 70% is moved along the scale. But the incentive to have a high efficiency is much higher for the people in the power plant, who typically deal with enormous amounts of power, than for me and you, who use very small amounts of energy. So there are a lot more, different devices taking electrical energy from the grid, very small amounts of energy, than power plants on the other side over there. So typically, the efficiency of our converters, energy converters here, is very low, between 50 and 75%. Whereas in the plant, you have an engineer working night and day to try to improve the efficiency of conversions of conversion efficiencies by a tiny fraction of a percent. So not every joule is the same. When we talk about energy, it's really important to compare what is comparable. A joule in terms of chemical energy in a drop of fuel is not a joule coming in from the power outlet in the room. I could give you 4 million joules spread into a swimming pool as heat, and you could do nothing with it. If I give you 1 million joules in the power cable in the forms of vibration of electrons, there's a lot more things you can do with that energy. The other important point is that not every efficiency is the same. So for example, when you heat water up in your building, you usually have the choice between burning gas or using electrical resistance, so burning electrical power. But these are not the same energies, not the same joules, it's not the same quality of energy. And typically the gas burning plant will have a much lower efficiency than the electrical one, but the electricity coming in the electrical heater itself comes from heat in the power plant behind. So we have to be really careful when we compare efficiencies of devices all along. They're not the same. Okay, so let's have a look at what is behind the wall plug. But physically, what kind of machines, what kind of installations are behind the wall plug? So I'm burning 30 watts with that computer right now. My total electrical consumption for computing devices at home with modem, with the laptop that sits on the table, always on, used as a Tor node, and that laptop used about 10 hours a day, is 30 watts. 30 watts round the clock, 24/7, 365 days a year. So where do these 30 watts come from? What is the impact of these 30 watts upstream? As you know, there are three main ways of generating electrical power at the source. One is fossil fuels, nuclear, and renewables. I won't talk too much about the relationships, well, what exactly happens in the power plants over there, fossil fuel and nuclear, especially when they're very controversial at the moment, especially for nuclear power. But the idea is here you have very raw sources of energy, either as atoms that you're going to break or as molecules that you can snap together that generate a lot of heat, and we convert that heat into movement. Whereas renewables, the energy is readily there as mechanical movements or solar energy right available in the place where you're at, and convert it directly to electricity without going through this heat phase over there. Typically, as a community, we look at the last one with a positive outlook for many reasons. One's obviously the environmental impact is much lower, but especially the amount of technology, then the amount of care, the amount of supervision that they need, and the amount of investments that these needs is much lower. So we feel much more much more able to work with these power sources. And I've heard already the Congress people who are proposing to use solar panels or wind power devices to power our own gadgets over there. But what most people call renewable energy sources, I rather call lower shelf tidbits. And the reason why they're lower shelf is because they're just right here along. You could actually put a wind power device in between the buildings right there. And they're tidbits because the amounts of energy that we get from these devices is extremely low in comparison to the other sources over there. So wind power, it's great. I mean, no question about that. But the amounts of energy and the amounts of power that you get from a wind turbine is a trickle in comparison to its size. You can probably remove the rotor of a wind turbine and you can fit a gas jet engine to create electricity just in the nacelle over there. And then you don't need to fit it on the mast that's 100 meters high, and don't need 100 truckloads of concrete on the floor to prevent the whole thing from tipping along. So the joke here is really meant as a self-satirical joke rather than cynicism. Actually, I hope to start soon a PhD on the aerodynamics of wind turbine blades. So I'm very fond of wind turbines. Have a very positive outlook on them. But we have to keep in mind that the amount of power that we get from these things is extremely low. Wind power would be great on Uranus. It's a joke, but it has some meaning behind. Uranus is very cold, very dense air, extremely high winds. It's very far away from the sun. It's minus 200 degrees over there. Perfect place to set your wind turbine. In the same way, solar panels. I mean, who's against solar power? That's fantastic. It would be perfect on Mercury. It's three times closer to the sun, and especially there's no atmosphere to filter the solar energy that you get. So that would definitely be the ideal power source to put on Mercury. And the point, of course, that I'm trying to make here is that the very reasons why we're alive and why we can walk outside and have a healthy life are the reasons why these renewable sources of energy are so weak, so very low power. In fact, if you want to fit something into the grid today as a source of energy, the main question you have to answer is how many euros are you paying? How many euros does your electrical joule cost you? And chemical energy in the form of oil is so incredibly dense and available in such vast amounts, despite what we say when we complain that the prices are rising, that it's still cheaper to get it than to make electrical power from the wind. And I think it's astonishing. It's cheaper to dive 10 kilometers below the surface ocean, the ocean surface, and then drill 50 kilometers below that and get the oil, pump it up, put it in a ship, ship the oil to the continent, refine that oil, burn the oil to make electricity and lose 30% in the process. And also clean up the mess when your oil drill goes horribly wrong and the oil comes gushing out into the ocean. And do all of this, it still comes out much cheaper to do that than to just fit a power turbine and get electricity straight in between the two buildings over there and the wind beating by the window over here. And that's, I think it's astonishing. And that's the main problem that we have to answer for renewable energies. It's not about efficiency or elegance or networks. It's just about price. How much euros, how many euros are you ready to pay for your electrical joule? So the point I'm trying to make, and probably the most important, one of the most important points I'm trying to make for the whole talk, is this energy is not just about joules. There are many different aspects to energy that we have to take into account. One is quality. An electrical joule is much more interesting to us than a joule as heat, and especially a joule as heat at low temperature. Availability is especially difficult problem to solve for renewable energy sources. Typically, we need power when it's neither windy nor sunny. Reactivity is an important one, and it works mostly in our favor. It's easy to turn down a wind turbine. It takes only a few seconds to throttle it down. It takes a few minutes to throttle down the gas turbine, and it takes a few hours to throttle down the nuclear power plant. So that's an important point that we have to work with. And the last one is density. How can you store the energy and how can you carry energy sources along? This is the reason why we never in our lifetimes are going to fly across the Atlantic in an electrical airplane. Right? Chemical energy is so incredibly dense, it's hard to compete with this. The nuclear area has strongly influenced the creation of the power grid in my country, in France, just over the border, and probably a lot influenced your power grid as well. And there are many reasons for that, and why we typically dislike this, one of which is the military history of nuclear power, or the association with the military history, and the military business has a very strong authoritarian culture, but very top-down for most obvious reasons, most top-down way of working around. It's also a field where there's a lot of secrecy. And the typical answer is it's none of your business. It also requires an enormous amount of supervision, and especially energy-intensive supervision, very expensive supervision with lots of engineers. And that results in something that we profoundly dislike in our communities, which is high concentrations of power. And that has terrifically influenced the way in which we design our network grids, right? We have very few extremely high power nodes powering a network that is mostly made of consuming nodes rather than producing nodes. And I see a lot of proposals around now that we should power our own devices with our own renewable energy sources. But I think the main issue at hand is not about just decentralized production. It's not about just taking a little bit of sunlight and plugging your power, your solar cell into the grid. It's about decentralized intelligence. By plugging a wind turbine into the grid, we're just making the work, the reflection harder for the centralized intelligence who is trying to arrange the continuously varying demand with the production and trying to predict the wind distribution across the country and the sun distribution across the country and the demand variation minute by minute. We're just making their work harder. We're not really solving the problem. What I'd like to see is us thinking about how we can distribute intelligence. That is, when am I going to take power and when am I going to give power to the grid and who's going to need it at what time? Just like the way we've designed networks with decentralized intelligence, not just decentralized bits. Okay, how am I doing for time? Good, all right. Not all drills are equal. That's a very important point that I'd like to make. In this whole process here, not only are we losing heat, losing energy as low-grade heat along as the way we go, but also the important point I want to make is that there's no way back. As you push energy along, you cannot convert it back to lower forms without again losing energy to heat. One typical way that we represent the energy transformation is as this, as you start with a lot of good energy, and as you go along and you transform energy, you lose some, right? And it makes me think of the Napoleonian army representation. That's a well-known 1869 drawing representing the Napoleonian army as it crossed the German border, going to Moscow, and the thickness represents the amount of soldiers in the army. So they start with 400,000 over here, and as they go along, when they reach Moscow, they're only 100,000, and by the time they make it back into the middle of winter, there's only 10,000 people left, right? So that's a big disaster. I mean, you've learned the lesson too, right? So something the French and Germans will always all agree about is never invade Russia in winter. But the point I'm trying to make is that this is a nice way of representing something where there's a loss that's avoidable, something that's not desirable. But for energy, it's not so. It happens that the transformation of heat into work is inherently, fundamentally, at a physical level, wasteful. It requires some energy to be wasted as low-grade heat, as low-temperature heat. So I spent quite a lot of time teaching thermodynamics, engineering thermodynamics in classes. So I had a lot of opportunity to think and play with these notions, and I'll try my best to explain why it is so. Basically, we're hindered by a curious property of heat, which is that it always flows towards the lowest temperature. Take a bar of metal at any given temperature and you heat it up. So you put a lighter just below that side here and give it a little bit of heat here. So the temperature increases on that side. And what typically happens is that the heat disperses and disperses. And after half an hour, what you get is just a mildly warm bar. And never, never, ever the opposite. There's no reason why all the energy that's spread into the bar would not concentrate and get back here. Right? There's no reason that when we describe the movement of the molecules, there's no direction in which these molecules tend to go that dictates this behavior. That's a really disturbing behavior. But if you jump in a swimming pool, you make a big splash, the energy is still there, right? You dissipate your energy, your kinetic energy, in terms of heat into the swimming pool. Why would the energy in the swimming pool not condense back under your feet and just push you out of the swimming pool so that you land on your 2 feet by the side? I mean, there's no, in Newton's law, there's nothing that tells you that this is impossible. And this is extremely disturbing. And it constrains the way that we transform heat into work in the following way. So how do you make work, a movement of a part, with heat?
right? You take a gas, but it could be, usually we use air, but it could be water, and you can think about it as just a piece of metal. It works with metal to make, think about the spring. And you put a source of heat below it. And as you give heat to the gas, the molecules bang against one another much more quickly, much more strongly, and the gas wants to expand, and you let the gas push on the surface, and voila, you've converted heat, which you had here, into a one nicely uniform movement of a part, with which now you can, say, spin a magnet inside a coil. But what happens when you're done? When you're done, if you've pushed all you could on the piston, and your gas is at mild temperature, there's no, and you'd like to start again, what you'd like to do is to get that gas to be at the same volume you had initially, and you want to start again, to do it continuously, for example, in the car engine. And the conundrum of the thermodynamic engineer is that you can't. There's no way to get back to where you were without dumping heat, without removing all the heat that's here spread into this gas, so it contracts and gets back to the start. Either you cool it and lose the heat at low temperature, or you just dump it. And by dumping it, you're just throwing away in the exhaust pipe of your engine all the heat that's left into this gas with which you have done nothing. So going from here to there, back to start, requires dumping energy. And whichever way you work around it, there's no way to avoid this. Yes, a question?
No question. You asked me to say...
Oh, it's half time. Perfect. Thank you very much. That's wonderful. So the idea here is that there's a fundamental limit to the proportion of heat that you can convert into work. Every time you want to extract random movement from the particles and condense that into a movement of a single part, a cool movement, a movement that does not dissipate, then you lose some of that energy as a low-grade heat. There are many ways to mitigate this effect, and in most, the biggest trick or hack that we bring to engines to try to mitigate this effect is to compress the gas before we add heat. So typically in the jet engine, in the car engine, before the combustion, we compress the gas to raise its temperature. So the higher the temperature of the gas, and we sort of prepare it to accept new heat in the combustion process. So that reduces the loss a little bit, but it turns out there's no way around a large amount of loss. So typically, the best you could do with a frictionless, perfectly designed, perfectly slow, perfectly large engine, typically for a given temperature, would be 70%. And by the time you make this compact and reactive and economical, cheap enough to be built, then it's down to 20-30%. And in comes something that's extraordinary in physics, in thermodynamics, to my point of view, which is Maxwell's demon. Maxwell, a physician, came along with an idea that's very similar to Schrödinger's cat. It's a thought experiment that tries to find the limit of a given statement. And Maxwell goes like this. It says, okay, well, you know, heat cannot go to the coolest places. If you have a gas, the heat will always disperse. What if I had a little demon on top of the gas here, and all the molecules are moving randomly, and a little demon opened and closed a tiny door here to let the hot molecules, the molecules that are really fast, into that side, and let the cool molecules, the slow molecules, into this side? Then that demon would not need any energy to open the door. It could be a very efficient, very small door. And progressively, what you get is that distribution of heat. So a very high temperature gas on this side and a very low temperature gas on this side, on the other side, at no expense of energy. It's like a refrigerator, but with no energy expense. And of course, it doesn't work. And the idea of Maxwell is not to prove that it doesn't work, it's just to find out what there is about this demon, this imaginary creature that fundamentally prevents us from making it without energy input. What is there about the demon that requires energy input? It's a very vast question. It's a topic for a 3 or 4 hour talk, which I'm not going to go into right now. But there it is. The idea is that raising energy up the scale requires expenditure of wasted of energy. One way of answering the question, just coming back to the slide here, is that when he's looking at the speed of the molecule, the demon has to store that information somewhere. And the amount of energy that is required to wipe the place where he's going to store the information and write this information is exactly the amount of energy that is required for input to cool the gas on one side and heat it up on the other side. So that's the first step from mechanics into the theory of information. This defines the minimum amount of energy that you have to put to store information. Okay. Imagine that you're starting from scratch. I mean, you probably made this thought experiment by your own already. So imagine that we're just as a group and we're left in, we're transported back in time 3,000 years ago, and there's no computers, there's no power outlets, and you have to start everything from scratch. Well, it's quite a challenge, isn't it? Even if we are together and we can still communicate and we have all the knowledge that we have today, it would be very hard to build everything from scratch again. And one of the challenges would be writing information. All that I know, let's write it. Let's put it somewhere that's available to other people. And there's no wiki, there's no network, there's no PC, there's no keyboard, there's nothing. You have to think about ways to store information. Then there's no paper, there's no stone carving, so you have to create everything by your own. Now the amount of energy that you're prepared to invest into writing, into creating this sorting of information. And the higher the amount of energy that you are going to have to spend to prepare the medium, right? Making a sheet of paper is quite a lot more work than finding a stone. Right? But then, of course, the writing on a sheet of paper takes a lot less energy than the carving inside the stone. So the more efficient you want to be storing information, and the more energy you're going to have to spend preparing the medium on which to store your information. One modern time equivalent of this thing is trying to compress data. I take a CD, my CD player, my portable CD player takes 7 watts to run, maybe a little high. That's why I measure. These are unreliable data, by the way. My iPod burns less than 1 watt, actually a smaller amount of power than I was able to detect with my device. Encoding one CD to FLAC, right, to taking the whole amount of information and storing it in a smaller amount of space, in a smaller amount of bits. But the same information requires energy input at a fundamental level. And by the way, the break-even is about 10 listings if you want to save energy. It's a moot point. I'm not trying to make a point about this because, of course, as you know, once you have one FLAC file, you'll have a million FLAC files, so not everybody has to compress the data. But the idea the point I want to make here is every time you want to make reading and writing of energy, of information more efficient, less costly in energy, you have to input energy at the first place to change your standard of writing in information. Yeah, don't simply trust this data, right? This is not research level data. This is just personal investigation, quick Saturday night investigation. From an energetic point of view, what is an information cable? Information cable is just a controlled amount of space on which the sensitivity to passing of information, the physical sensitivity to passing the amount of information is extraordinary. And the more energy you're prepared to invest into making sure that the copper in the wire is very pure, or the transparency of your optical fiber is high, then the smaller amount of energy you're going to be required to stream that information along. So the more efficient the energy storage, the more sensitive the device at the other side. Right? An iPod is harder to create than a CD player, than a 33 RPM plastic disk device. And also, the more efficient your energy, your information storage device, and the greater the preliminary energy input you're going to have to put in it. Okay, let me just go into one last chapter, one risky chapter, trying to make the analogy or the comparison between life and this retrieval and creation of energy. And I'll start with a simple question: what is the amount of energy you need to make a pot of honey? It's an impossible question to answer. By the way, the self-appointed benevolent dictator of the Ubuntu project, Mark Shuttleworth, is now into beehives, right? For his hobby, he's got a couple of beehives. I think it's a very fitting analogy for the GNU and Linux community to be able to manage beehives to make honey. But we can't make honey artificially. Bees do make a substance that we cannot recreate in chemical ways. So we have to have beehives. How could we calculate the amount of energy that it requires to take all the sugar that's spread into a million different rosemary flowers and cherry tree flowers and condense this into one pot of honey? A single bee will only produce a tiny amount of honey in its whole lifetime, right? Less than a spoonful of honey in its whole lifetime. So what is the amount of energy? What is the amount of energy that's required to do that? Well, you could calculate the amount of energy that the bee spends along, just to stream along, to fly along per second, and then look at all the distance it's flown in its whole lifetime. A very complex calculation, but then you have to take into account what the bees have been doing to the environment that changes the energy input and output in the environment, right? The bees allow trees to reproduce and more flowers to come along. Many birds will eat trees, will eat bees. So you have a whole spreading of this energy effect of just collecting honey into a very wide environment, which makes it an impossible question to answer: how much energy is required to input honey. I spent myself, in unfortunate circumstances, quite some time on the hospital bed a few years ago, and I came to realize two very interesting things. The first one is that recovery is particularly difficult. And especially we're not prepared, we're not used in our culture, in our lifetimes, to deal with physical pain, sustained or intense physical pain. And that once you find yourself subject to physical pain, it's extremely difficult to engage into meaningful and interesting conversations or production or exchange of information with other people. It's actually quite a surprising discovery to me. And a French philosopher, Michel Serres, expresses this in quite a nice way, I think. He says that although the invisible, the increase in life expectancy and the reduction in suffering that we encounter contribute to a different perception of time, of projects, and of the world. So just by being able to not suffer, because we have extremely high control over our physical bodies these days, we're able to think and gather up in conferences like today to create spread information, exchange information. Continues to say, our forerunners' ethics exerted the will to live against the inevitable constraints of suffering and premature death, while our ethics, our own ethics, emanate from the freedom we obtain from these. And I think in other words, my interpretation of this is saying that, in our context, is saying that all the joyful trailblazing that we're going through in the digital age, right? With the opening keynote person this morning said this very well. The whole new ways of inventing society that we're going through, they are inherently linked to the enormous progress that we've made in controlling our own bodies. We do not have to worry about sustaining ourselves or preventing suffering because we have so much control in our society over that. The other big realization I had is that sterility requires an enormous amount of energy. And there's a surprising amount of effort and of material that's spent in the hospital room to keep it clean, to keep it sterile. If you don't clean the floor every day, if you don't spend a whole lot of material trying to keep it sterile, then spontaneously it goes unsterile and then you compromise the recovery of your patients. And again, to me, this is really a way of saying that in order to have control over environment and to have control over life, to give your patient more control over his or her own life, then you have to input enormous amount of energy onto this. So instead of life as ruthless self-preservation, and that's something that we may see quite often in our culture, I've changed, or another point of view could be that life is a perpetual reach for purer forms of energy. It's continually avoiding this randomness of energy transfers and raising the quality of the energy. Right? We just we could see the human body as just a physical space where the transfer of energy is taking place. Another way of seeing it is that typically we see life as something that's very cyclic, right? The seasons go by, and okay, the horse dung goes onto the grass, fertilizes the grass, and the grass feeds the horse, something like that. And the chicken makes the egg, and the egg makes the chicken, and so on and so forth. Something that keeps going, some self-sustaining virtuous circle. But the fact is that making a chicken out of an egg requires input of energy. That energy is not going into the chicken, it's dumped down to lower forms of energy at the bottom. So make another thought experiment. You blanket the earth, and you prevent it from receiving sunlight, but you prevent it from cooling off too, right? So the amount of energy that's in the earth stays constant. We'd probably die off within just a few years, because this incoming high quality, high frequency solar energy from the sun is what powers the whole plant mechanism, right? Photosynthesis is nothing than taking solar energy and grabbing air, right, and making wood out of it, grabbing the carbon from the air, making wood out of it, something that we invert in our cars and we take the carbon and dump the carbon into the air, releasing the useful energy into it. Another, just and perhaps a risky comparison is to say that Maxwell's demon, this imaginary concept of something or someone that structures matter to give it some kind of meaning at the cost of energy input, is us, is exactly what we keep doing with our computers, with our networks. We structure matter. We take random arrangements of bits and we structure them so that they carry meaning suddenly. So we are, as a human population, are quite one form of Maxwell's demon. So my answer to does ping CCC point AA require any energy input is yes, it does. I'm not able to quantify how much. Actually, probably the pure the energy you put into the device, so the more controlled it is, and the less energy you need, right? So it requires very little energy. We've seen it's just a few drops of fuel a minute to power an ordinary computer. But it's very high-grade energy that you need to put into the device to do this. Very high up the scale, requiring lots of dumping of low-grade energy. And especially it requires significant preliminary energy input. By the time that you've built devices that are sensitive enough that they can detect and react to very small amounts of physical variation of any kind, you spent an enormous, tremendous amount of energy. And that's always overlooked when we talk about energy efficiency in our devices. So just to put things in perspective, this is a graph of time. This is a timeline of life on Earth. This is the beginning of the Earth as we know it. There's a big floating rock in space, still is. And as time passes, here we come, right at the end. Homo erectus is at the back. Okay, let me try to get a tiny bit more space on the right here. Here we go. Right, so life appears about here. Then multicellular organisms, which is probably what we as non-biologists recognize as life, appears about at this point. Dinosaurs are over here. And Homo erectus, which again is not a definition of human, but something probably human that we recognize as being part of ours, just like the bunch of us in the queue in the morning to come into SIGINT, right? Appears right in this tiny bit of segment over there. And we have to zoom in that part here to see exactly at which point we come in. And here we go. This is the green bit here is that green bit there, here. And here we are. Humans appear right in this red spot here on the side in the time scale of the Earth. And if you zoom into that red bar here and take it again, and you can see that history, our entire period of time where we have started writing information, committing information to physical medium, is the blue slice right on the side of the red slice here, and it's not visible. You have to zoom in to see it. And just even here, we can't really see it. Now it's zooming in that red thing here. So coming back to the previous slide, this one here. In order to be able to see history, the whole period of time over which we've committed information into physical media, you have to squish this bar and stretch it along. And then here we go. That's history over here, right? This blue part inside the red part, which was inside the green part that we've seen before. And now zooming in that blue part here, the whole history, at last, here we are, right? 5,000 years of committing information to physical media. Jesus Christ is here. It's a good historical reference. Electricity is in the late 1600s, first serious study of electricity. And then we come to computers in the late 1940s over here. And you know what? The best thing you've ever seen on the computer, the best piece of software you've ever used, the best media, the best text you've ever read, all comes in that kind of tiny zone here, which is nothing in the grand scheme of things. And this brings me to say two things. One, the evolutionary process by which we have been able to sustain ourselves, to have sufficient control over our bodies that we can spend time together in the Congress exchanging information rather than trying just figuring out how to survive. That process is extremely long. That's right. It's structuring of matter to a self-sustaining point. That's just remarkable. The other thing is, it's quite, I think, quite remarkable that we're ready to subscribe into debts, have enormous debts into the future generations, into timescales that are hundreds of years away in the future, and perhaps millions of years in the future with nuclear power, just for something that has happened in a tiny bit here. That's all very, very, very fresh and very recent. So no wonder it feels like trailblazing. No wonder it's just such an exhilarating experience, that digital world. It's just very, very fresh. It's just very, very new. Right? So I'll conclude on that sentence, which is that our fresh computing infrastructure, which is just very recent, is inextricably tied to a complex and precarious energy network, one that was built from the top down, and one that has significant impacts in very long timescales with regards to our existence. The question I really want to ask with the talk, and look forward to your input to that, is what are we going to do about it? So thanks very much. Do you have any questions? I'll take that microphone here and hand this microphone over to whoever wants to have any input, any remarks, any reactions. Was this talk what you expected it to be? Has anybody measured their own electrical consumption of their own device so far? Yes? 1%, but two people? Did it feel like a surprise? To me, it was a great surprise. 30 watts is quite a lot of effort if I had to provide them myself into a work machine. No reactions? Okay, well, we'll wrap it up like this. Thank you very much for your attention.